This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 20th, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. bombs target Taliban forces struggling to maintain control of their last stronghold. The Philippines president comes to Washington seeking weapons to fight rebels in her country. And more on the international treaty outlawing germ warfare that the U.S. refuses to sign. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. UNICEF says it's a race against time to reach the children of Afghanistan. Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Speaking today from the border between Uzbekistan and northern Afghanistan, a representative of the United Nations Children's Fund said that without immediate aid, 120,000 Afghan children will die of hunger, illness, and cold. UN agencies started delivering aid by barge last week from Termez, Uzbekistan, to an Afghan port 11 miles down the Amudarya River. But Uzbek authorities today refused to open a vital bridge between the two countries, citing strong winds and security concerns. The UN's World Food Program says more than 3 million Afghans in northern regions need aid delivered from former Soviet Central Asia. Elsewhere in Afghanistan, according to the UN, WFP is leading efforts to stave off hunger. An agency spokesman said today more than 1,300 tons of food, enough for 160,000 people for 1 month, are on their way to Kabul. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Parents may get flexible work hours in the UK if the proposed law goes through. Anastasia Kershaw reports from London.
Working parents in Britain will be given the chance to seek shorter hours after new legislation that should be active by 2003. Government Trade Secretary Patricia Hewitt unveiled guidelines yesterday allowing parents with young children to ask employers for flexible working times. Economists predict this will lead to around 500,000 applications, of which 80% should be successful. In Britain, time off for parents is fiercely resisted by many employers and will not be an automatic right. Instead, firms have to consider all requests, but they can still reject an application if it's damaging to the business. But campaigners are likely to be dissatisfied as they want older children included in the reforms. This is Anastasia Kershaw reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Two journalists working for the only independent daily in Zimbabwe have been released from jail, again highlighting the harsh treatment of the Mugabe government towards journalists. Naeem Jina reports from neighboring South Africa.
Last night, two journalists that had been arrested on Sunday were released. The men, working for the country's only privately owned daily, were arrested after allegedly witnessing torture by opposition party supporters. They were not charged. Police say the two witnessed a man being forced by MDC members into implicating the National Spy Agency in the recent murder of war veterans leader Kane Nkala, a Mugabe supporter. The Daily News says its journalists were arrested to prevent them from publishing an interview with an MDC activist who claimed to know details of Nkala's murder. This is Naeem Jina in Johannesburg for Free Speech Radio News.
The numbers of hate crimes committed in the United States increased, but the FBI won't say whether or not there's a trend. Ellen Ratner reports from D.C.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation Hate Crime Statistic Report for the year 2000 indicates a 2% increase in hate crimes from 1999 to the year 2000. Mandated by Congress, the Hate Crimes Act of 1990 requires the FBI to compile data on bias-motivated crime. The FBI emphasizes, however, that it's practically impossible to track hate crime records. Mary Victoria Pine of the Federal Bureau of Investigation explains why.
We do not trend hate crime information because the number of participating agencies varies from year to year. We like to say that the hate crime book offers a perspective on the general nature of hate crime occurrence.
Pine therefore declined to discuss possible trends associated with the recent rise in reported incidents. Even so, 187 more hate crimes were reported in the year 2000. The FBI statistics also include crimes motivated by sexual orientation and disability, making them one of the only crime databases in the country to do so. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ellen Ratner in Washington, D.C.
And finally, protesters on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques will begin their campaign of civil disobedience again. They had stopped after the attacks on September 11th. The call for protest comes in response to the Navy's request of the Pentagon to begin their live bombing of the small Caribbean island. Protesters say the bombings do severe damage to the people who live there and the environment. Just prior to the attacks, President Bush said he would suspend live bombing on Vieques, only allowing so-called dummy bombs to be dropped until 2003, when the Navy would find another location. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S. warplanes continued their assaults on Afghanistan today, trying to stomp out the last areas of Taliban control. With the Taliban withdrawn from all of Afghanistan's major cities except their stronghold Kandahar, the country is left with no central government and rival factions are jockeying for power. Many Afghans fear that violence and crime will soar, and there are already signs of that. Yesterday, four journalists were killed by armed men on the road to Kabul. Correspondent Tony Cross was robbed at gunpoint on the same road on Sunday. He files this report from Kabul.
Our car was flagged down at a checkpoint by four excited young men brandishing Kalashnikovs. I knew something wasn't right when I heard the click of a safety catch being taken off as they wrenched the car doors open. One kept our Afghan driver with the car with the Kalashnikov to his head all the time. The others drove us away from the road, hitting us with their guns. When we stopped at the end of a small ravine, I think we all thought we were going to die. But they took all the money we had on us, told us to stay where we were, and went back to the car. We didn't move until we heard the driver calling to find more valuables had been taken, but at least we were alive. Our colleague from Radio France International, Joanne Sutton, and two other journalists killed during the fighting 12 days ago weren't so lucky, nor were the people killed yesterday. And then there are the thousands of Afghan dead. The boys, they were only 18 to 20 years old, whose itchy trigger fingers frightened us so, have known nothing but war all their lives. 97% of Afghan children have experienced violence, and 65% have experienced the death of a close relative. With the collapse of the Taliban, the streets are once again packed with armed men. It brings back grim memories of 1992 to 1996, when the factions that now control Kabul fought it out for power at the cost of 100,000 lives. Today people say that they didn't like the Taliban, but at least they brought security. Then there are the warlords and tribal leaders who are running the east of the country. In Jalalabad, four Pashtun factions have formed a shaky coalition to run their province. They say they're ready to negotiate with the Northern Alliance, which is made up of other smaller ethnic groups, but they don't seem to be in any hurry. Mohammed Alim, spokesman for Jalalabad's new security chief, Haji Saman, promised miracles on Sunday.
It will control within 1 or 2 days. You know, yesterday was good and today is better and tomorrow will be the best.
Unfortunately, Alim proved to be optimistic. No wonder most Afghans are weary and cynical. Mohammed Ahmed is a doctor who hasn't been paid for 4 months, can't find medicines and instruments for his hospital, but still keeps working. He has as much contempt for today's winners as he had for yesterday's rulers.
They want to take the position. They don't think about the people that will they, to they give the, to them salary or other thing. Just the position and the guns, and they will every and in every street you will see a new king.
Today, the United Nations announced that it will hold a conference of Afghans in Germany as soon as possible to try and form a government. It's not yet sure if the Pashtun groups in the east and the south will attend. Even if they do, it's difficult to imagine peace and stability any day soon. Tony Cross for Free Speech Radio News in Kabul.
The Northern Alliance is getting help from U.S. forces attempting to make sure groups working with the Taliban are not allowed to flee to other countries. One of those groups is Osama bin Laden's terrorist network, Al-Qaeda. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made the comments today after meeting with the president of the Philippines. Rumsfeld says the U.S. is working with the Philippines in battling Abu Sayyaf rebels, who are believed to have ties to Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden's invisible network is believed to be insidious and far-reaching. John Quigley, professor of international law at Ohio State University, fears that capturing the head of al-Qaeda may not necessarily undercut the terrorist activities.
There's a question of the reach of al-Qaeda outside of Afghanistan, and it seems to have major operations and support in Egypt, which is the most populous of the Arab states, and that where one of the primary individuals in the al-Qaeda organization, Dr. Zahrawi, is from. So that it might well be that, that if there was a movement out of Afghanistan, there would simply be a taking up of operations somewhere else.
If there are other cells in different Arab states and throughout the world, presumably the governments in those states and countries will target these groups as well.
Well, some of these governments may indeed help. I mean, the government of Egypt, it would be very happy to, not to have any of this going on in Egyptian territory, but and they've been dealing with it in a sense, but the organizations are still functioning there.
Okay, so it's not really a whole lot that they can do or have done or perhaps are even prepared to do to try to really eradicate cells of the Taliban.
Yes, I think it's difficult for them. And, I mean, many of the people have been recruited from Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government, too, I'm sure would be happy not to have any of this going on in its territory. But the Saudi monarchy is not all that solid and probably needs to promote some of these groups or at least let them operate as a condition for remaining in power itself. So it's not clear that the Saudi monarchy, however willing it might be, is capable of dealing with this.
John Quigley, professor of international law at Ohio State University. As the diplomatic wrangling continues over the future of Afghanistan, speculation is rising about which countries will be targeted next by the Bush administration. Philippine President Gloria Arroyo is presently in the U.S., where she has met with military officials reportedly asking for weapons and attack helicopters from Washington for use in the Philippine government's operations against rebels in the south of the country. But as Jeremy Scahill reports, weapons may not be the only American military product to head to the Philippines.
The Bush administration's so-called war on terror is far from over. Heavy bombing continues in Afghanistan. Civilians continue to pay a heavy price. But as the United Nations says it's making progress on what is already a chaotic diplomatic road in Afghanistan, there is increasing talk in Washington and around the world of where President Bush will next take his war. While many in the administration are reportedly pushing for bombing Iraq, there's been a lot of discussion lately of the Philippines, where government forces have been battling Muslim rebels. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
We have a team in making an assessment and providing some advice and working with the Philippine troops. They have been putting pressure on the terrorists. And there was no question but that there has been a good deal of interaction between the terrorists in the Philippines and the al-Qaeda and people in Iraq and people in other terrorist-sponsoring states.
Should Washington expand its war to the Philippines, it would be distinctly different from the current attacks on Afghanistan or future attacks on Iraq. Namely, the U.S. would do so with the permission of the Philippine government. The U.S. military officially left the country a decade ago after the Philippine Senate voted to effectively oust Washington's military bases there. But over the last few days, controversy has arisen in the Philippines after reports emerged that the government was negotiating a secret deal with Washington that would pave the way for a virtual restoration of the former U.S. military bases. Washington has already dispatched what it calls military advisors to the Philippines, it says, to assist the government there in its operations against Muslim rebels. Today, President Gloria Arroyo was at the Pentagon for meetings with senior U.S. military officials.
Both countries are looking at this framework and looking at where the partnership in fighting terrorism domestically, regionally, and globally can become more effective.
Standing alongside President Arroyo outside the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld ultimately refused today to say whether U.S. troops would be heading to the Philippines.
Look, the United States has had a long relationship with the Philippines. We've had a cooperative relationship. They have a very fine army, and they have been working on this problem, and we are happy to provide the kinds of assistance that they feel is appropriate, and we have been doing so.
Any talk of the Pentagon reopening its bases in the Philippines or sending in U.S. troops draws outrage from human rights groups there who have long documented crimes and abuses by U.S. military personnel in the Philippines. But in the weeks after September 11th, human and civil rights are being cast aside. not just in America, but in countries around the world, all in the name of fighting terror. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
What a difference a month makes. As the United States continues to bombard the feudal state of Afghanistan with the gleeful yet anxious connivance of a bevy of assorted junior partners, the playlist of who's who seems to get rewritten by the hour.
Death row inmate and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal,
unperturbed by the Churchillian axiom that a nation has no permanent friends nor permanent enemies, but only permanent interests, the U.S. has cast a wide imperial net to scoop up a bucketful of bodies. The resultant quasi-coalition is a reflection of the wide and deep contradictions that emerge when one considers what the U.S. announces is its foreign policy and what it is in real politics. If the U.S. is the target of the terrorists because of its wonderful democracy, as non-majority elected President Bush suggests, why is it bundled up with nations that see democracy as a bad word? Pakistan and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia are many things, but democracies, they ain't. Only one person voted for General Musharraf to become president of Pakistan, himself. Because he was general, his was the only vote that counted. In clear, unalloyed terms, Pakistan is a military dictatorship. Worse, it is an unstable state where upwards of 80% of its population support the Taliban in Afghanistan, which exists in part because of the machinations of Pakistani military intelligence. The Saudi kingdom is, in essence, a theocracy, where the royal family rules with an iron hand, and where women aren't even allowed to drive. The bin Laden clan is one of the first families of the kingdom, builders of many of the structures in the Islamic holy places, such as Mecca. The Wahhabi sect of Islam promoted by the royal house is but a variant of that practiced by the Taliban. The madrasas in Pakistan, of which there are over 10,000, were, for the better part of two decades, training schools for the Taliban, and in fact, educated perhaps 75% of its leadership. Pakistan, being a desperately poor post-colonial nation, cannot afford real public education for its teeming young population. The madrasas, therefore, being the only free schools in the region, are plush with students who learn a thorough Quranic education with history from an Islamic perspective. The backers of the madrasa? Saudi Arabia. Okay, Jamal, what's the point? Thoughtful people will ask at this point. The point is that the two best buds of the USA, ally number one, Pakistan, and ally number two, Saudi Arabia, are the prime movers, backers, supporters, and sustainers of the so-called enemy, the Taliban. If 80% of Pakistanis support the Taliban in a region where one's ethnicity or tribal allegiances may go deeper than religion, what can any government, even a military dictatorship, do to suppress that expression? The American bombing campaign is sowing the pregnant seeds of civil war in Pakistan and rolling instability in the entire region. For the closer the U.S. nestles to Pakistan, the more nervous the Democratic Republic of India gets. Those two nations are already involved in an on-again, off-again shooting war over the northern Indian, or is it western Pakistani, province of Kashmir. Kashmir, with its overwhelmingly Muslim population, has been agitating for home rule and national independence for decades. To the Indians, Kashmiri militants are terrorists. To the Pakistanis, they look a whole lot like freedom fighters. Now, isn't that the same thing that was said about the Taliban when they were Mujahideen fighting the Soviets? The U.S. charges into a thicket, knowing neither its enemies nor its real friends. It is a time of danger that holds dangers not just for the U.S., nor even the region, but for the world. From Death Row, for Free Speech Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Washington is accusing Iraq, North Korea, and Iran of violating a ban on biological weapons. U.S. diplomats made the statements at the start of a United Nations conference in Geneva designed to beef up an international treaty outlawing germ warfare. As Monica Lopez reports, it's a treaty the U.S. refuses to sign.
John Bolton, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms National Security, accused Iraq of violating the international ban on bioweapons development, production, and stockpiling. Bolton said the U.S. also suspects North Korea, Iran, and Libya of having the ability to develop bioweapons.
An unfortunate number of the states party to the Biological Weapons Convention are flatly violating the terms of the convention with the conduct of an operational biological weapons program.
Bolton expressed concern over allowing United Nations weapons inspectors into U.S. labs. In July, U.S. State Department negotiators walked away from talks that would establish international bioweapons inspection teams and the law to back them up. Instead, Bolton asked for the support of delegates on the international criminalization of bioweapons development, including the extradition of scientists and personnel and increased export controls. Again, Undersecretary of State John Bolton.
It's more effective to rely on the adoption of national criminal legislation rather than slog through seven more years of negotiation as we've just finished with the draft protocol that resulted in something that we found both ineffective and unacceptable for other reasons. We think this is a better way to proceed.
Advances in biotechnology and the strength of the biotech industry in the United States may have applied sufficient pressure to influence the Bush administration and Bolton's statements. Tariq Rauf is director of the International Organizations and Nonproliferation Program in Monterey.
One of the reasons why the U.S. backed away from this negotiation in Geneva in July was because the U.S. biotech industry was very concerned that being the leading industry in the world in this area, it felt that by allowing intrusive inspections, the U.S. would lose its competitive edge. And by the same token, they also wanted to control trade in biotech in a manner that the transfers would be properly accounted for to ensure that they were not being misused.
To establish strong legal means to back up the findings of weapons inspectors has been a key objective and the subject of 7 years of negotiations among nonproliferation advocates. Now, Tariq Rauf isn't sure that this kind of a strong legal protocol will come to fruition.
I would be, the term I think that is used is guardedly optimistic. I think as a result of September 11 attacks on the U.S. and the anthrax letters in the U.S., countries have suddenly woken up that this is a real possibility that could hit them as well. So I think there would be a lot of political support for trying to get some agreement. But what might be standing in the way might be some U.S. reluctance in agreeing to a multilateral instrument.
Face-to-face negotiations of the Bioweapons Convention will continue in Geneva until December 7th. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Monica Lopez.
It has been nearly 2 years since World Trade Organization meetings in Seattle sparked a protest movement that has hounded global trade and finance ministers at virtually every meeting since 1999. But as the war in Afghanistan, the recent WTO meeting in Qatar, and the new anti-terrorism laws had G20 protest organizers in Ottawa last weekend questioning the future of the anti-corporate globalization movement, John Hamilton reports.
On September 10th, organizers with the Mobilization for Global Justice were busy preparing what was expected to be the largest demonstration against the World Bank and International Monetary Fund ever held in the United States. Some estimates, including those of the Washington, D.C. Metro Police, were predicting that 100,000 would converge on the Capitol to protest World Bank and IMF policies on September 30th. Of course, those meetings were canceled after the September 11th attacks, when the World Bank and IMF finally held their talks in Ottawa last weekend. A significantly smaller number of protesters took to the streets amidst a new climate of fear and with uncertainty about how best to continue their work. Maud Barlow of the Council of Canadians said that the anti-corporate globalization movement needed to reassess its tactics.
I think that there's a new kind of sensitivity to vandalism or, you know, smashing a McDonald's window and so on. We're really asking people not to do that. We're really saying, first of all, we want to reach out to more people and get our message out. And in this atmosphere of criminalizing of dissent and these terrible anti-terrorist bills they brought in your country and they brought in Canada, they brought in Great Britain, which are suspending civil liberties, we have to be really, really careful that we speak to the hearts and minds of as many people as we can. And so we're asking people to self-discipline.
Despite their newfound uncertainty over tactics, most organizers of groups protesting the WTO, IMF, and World Bank can agree on one thing, that after 2 years in the international spotlight, these institutions have not fundamentally changed their policies, and that protests should continue. Liddy Nakpil of the Freedom from Debt Coalition drew loud applause at a teach-in held in Ottawa last weekend when she rejected World Bank calls for an end to street demonstrations in favor of what the bank called constructive dialogue.
These experiences at participating in debates and discussions and so-called consultations have clearly shown to us that it has all been a waste of time. There are no signs of meaningful changes in the framework and policies of these institutions. It is not surprising, therefore, that there is now a growing movement worldwide calling for the shutdown of these institutions.
As U.S. bombs continue to rain down on Afghanistan and as civilian casualties mount, many in the anti-corporate globalization movement are calling for a merger with the peace movement. Many charge that the institutions of the global economy foster the wide gap between the rich and the poor of the planet, something they say provides fertile breeding ground for terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda. Antonia Juhas of the International Forum on Globalization cited a 1999 CIA report as an ominous warning against future terrorist attacks.
The rising tide of the global economy will create many economic winners, but it will not lift all boats. It will spawn conflicts at home and abroad, ensuring an even wider gap between regional winners and losers than exists today. Globalization's evolution will be rocky, marked by a chronic financial volatility and a widening economic divide. Regions, countries, and groups feeling left behind will face deepening economic stagnation, political instability, and cultural alienation. They will foster political, ethnic, ideological, and religious extremism, along with the violence that often accompanies it.
As many countries introduce anti-terror legislation likely to give authorities wide latitude to police future demonstrations, and as groups like the WTO increasingly meet in distant and authoritarian countries like Qatar, the anti-corporate globalization movement now faces a number of hurdles. But Nigerian environmental activist Oronto Douglas says that the struggle must continue if countries of the Global South are to finally achieve economic self-governance.
Good governance cannot happen when the people are not free. Good governance cannot happen when the waters are not clean. Good governance cannot happen when the air that you breathe is not pure. Good governance cannot happen when a few will genetically modify products and bring it to your table for you to eat. Good governance cannot happen when you are not part of the decision-making process. Good governance can only happen when the people in Canada, the people in the United States, the people in Nigeria decide to take charge of their own destiny and make it possible for every single child not to go to bed hungry. That is when good governance will happen.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters in 14 states and on four continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with the financial support of community radio stations and donations from listeners like you. You can find out how to support Free Speech Radio News by going to our website, www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. This newscast is produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown.